On our morning show from WRCO and WRCE, we have State Senator Howard Markline on today, along with Representative Todd Novak, joining us in the program for various subjects. But, Todd, we want to talk a little bit about basketball kicking it off, and how exciting was it for Mineral Point? I bet that was a celebration.
Oh, yeah, that town was exploding this weekend. Those two games were just amazing, and those kids worked their heart out, and it showed. But talk about on the edge of your seat basketball games. That was fantastic to watch. I wish I would have gone up and seen it happen. But it's pretty festive in Mineral Point this weekend. So,
and Coach Dan Burrison is a neighbor of yours.
Yep, he lives just a couple, three houses down. So yeah, so he's a good guy. He lives coaching, and he's a great teacher, a great coach, so I'm really happy for him. So,
did he ask you to drop any plays or anything?
No. Trust me, you don't want Todd anywhere near any sports.
Well, it was certainly exciting. And Howard, I think in sports and high school sports, that's something I think we can all agree on, can't we?
Oh, gosh, I hope so. Yeah, it was just wonderful for Mineral Point, obviously. I was at the Iowa County Cattlemen's spring banquet on Saturday night, and attendance was down a little bit. But, of course, there's a lot of people from Mineral Point that were at the basketball game that, you know, hadn't made it back yet. So at least that's what they're speculating. And, you know, I would have gone to the basketball game too. So, but and of course the Badgers, they finished the season strong, and it's not over. I'm just glad that they're gelling right now, it appears. And yesterday, I just sensed near the end of the game, it kind of ran out of gas. I mean, that's tough, playing four games in 4 days like that. So, hopefully, you know, we'll have a good tourney run here, and we'll be able to watch the Badgers hopefully for maybe a couple of weekends.
That would be awesome. At least get through this weekend, and we'll see what happens. Well, we want to jump right to it, of course. Lots of news out of Madison and across the state of Wisconsin and redistricting. And I think since the last time we talked, you kind of got a little bit more clear what your next district is looking like, Howard.
Right. So since I was here last, the whole redistricting thing has been put to bed. And I guess from a process standpoint, if I could, last April, a new Supreme Court justice was elected. She was sworn in on August 1st, August 2nd. The lawsuit was filed for new maps. And the basis for the lawsuits was that the districts were not contiguous. And, you know, I think that maybe the best example I can give is maybe a municipal-owned golf course. So let's say, a city of X has a golf course that's outside of town a mile, but it's not contiguous, okay? So technically, from a constitutional standpoint, that's a non-contiguous district. So that was the legal basis that they filed that. Now, it's interesting. Statewide, in these non-contiguous parcels of land, there were 88 people that lived in them. So, I mean, it wasn't a issue of a lot of people not being represented and stuff. So anyway, that was the basis. On December 22nd, late Friday, right before Christmas, the Supreme Court said because of the non-contiguous issue, the maps were unconstitutional. And that they ruled that you have until January 12th to submit maps to the courts. And they also hired two consultants to assist the court, one from California, Irvine, and somebody from out in the East Coast. So, again, two solid, being facetious here, two solid Midwest guys. And the maps were submitted. I think there was six maps submitted to the courts, and the consultant said that the two, state legislature submitted a map that corrected all of these non-contiguous parcels, okay, that we fixed that and submitted that, because that was the basis for the lawsuit. And these two experts said that that wasn't constitutional. And so there were four maps left. All of them were pretty different from what we've had in the past. And one of them was the Governor Evers maps. And so the legislature, we ended up passing Governor Evers maps. And it was kind of interesting because the Democrats voted against it. And because I think they figured that the court's going to give them a better outcome than what the Evers maps were. So, but anyways, that ended up getting passed, and the governor did sign that. So, and what that means is that for the elections this fall in November, that we'll have these new district maps in place. Now, that sounds like a simple thing. However, there's a lot of questions, you know, like, for example, in my Senate district has for decades run basically north and south. And there have been some tweaks over the years, east and west, or, you know, kind of thing. But it's basically been a north-south, very rural district. My district now runs east-west, and it's all, except for Crawford County, all south of the river. So I'm drawn out of my district. So I can, from my house now, I don't live in the 17th Senate District, but I can see it out my window. That's how close it is. But and here in Richland County, Richland County is now part of the 14th Senate District, which runs from all of Richland County runs east into the city of Madison. Okay. And, you know, as I've talked to a lot of people, I'm not sure what the village of Boaz and the city of Madison have in common. Okay. I mean, they're just two different communities, or Casanova, or, you know, Ithaca, some of our small rural burgs in the city of Madison. I just don't see how those communities have anything in common with the city of Madison. Yeah. So anyway, so it's going to be interesting. I'll be in tomorrow night. I'll be in Ithaca, or in Ithaca. I'll be in Seneca, and meeting with the town's unit meeting there. I've been to Prairie du Chien, spending some time there. So for me, it's part of a new district, and we'll have to go out and just meet people and start getting involved in their local events. So, and I don't know, like in the assembly, they're going. There's been a lot of what are called pairings in the Senate. We've got like up in the Green Bay area, we've got three Republican senators. We're all drawn into one Senate district. So there's, but again, I don't think that was by accident. It'll be interesting to watch over the next month or two to see kind of where people end up going or moving to. From a timing standpoint, nomination papers, we begin to circulate them on April 15th. So that's not too far away here. So, you know, they'll be out, and, you know, people have to figure out, you know, where they're going to run, where their districts are, and then where they're going
to
run.
Do you have to move?
I'm going to continue to represent the 17th Senate District.
Okay. So you have to live in it though, right? Or not? How does it work?
Well, it has been precedent that, like in my case, I'm not up for 2 years. So, right. What has been the precedent has been that in somebody like myself, and there's two or three of us in that situation, it has always been the precedent that you can continue to live where you're at. You don't have to move until you're up for election the next time. So that, you know, if you're elected and you would have to live in your district at that point. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised at all if there's a lawsuit. It seems like there's all kinds of lawsuits going on right now. Lots of lawsuits going on right now. And it's interesting. They all go right directly to the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court now. There's no going up through district court and court of appeals. I'm just going to have to wait and see what happens. You know, I fully intend to continue to serve in the 17th Senate District, and we'll have to see how things play out.
Todd, how does it affect you? It's kind of different for you too, isn't it?
Yeah, I lose Richland County. Richland County will all go to Tony Ripson and Kurtz, which, you know, is good and bad. So mine got more compact right now. You know, I go all the way to Loganville, down to the Illinois border, south of in Lafayette County and Greene County. I have the Monroe portion of Greene County. So I have all of Lafayette County, which I already have most of it. All of Iowa County, I have a little over half of Iowa County right now. I have all Iowa County. Some of Grant County, the northern part of Grant County, and then a little of the southern part. But the interesting part is I also have Mount Horeb and Blue Mounds now, and kind of go back to what Howard said. I'm not quite sure what the Blue Mounds and Mount Horeb has in common with Lafayette County, but we'll see. I'm not too, a lot of the area I picked up, the people know me in Iowa County. You know, I was at the paper for 20 years as editor, so they all know me and stuff. It's kind of a cool kind of thing is I graduated from Iowa Grant, so the area I picked up from Grant County is all the old Iowa Grant or the school district I graduated from, except for like Muscadine over there. So I know those people too. So it was an interesting process. I will be the people that don't know me, I'll get to know them. I will say that I'm afraid the door will be opened now for every time the Supreme Court changes, we will have new maps. And I'm not sure that's a good thing. There's got to be a better way to do this than, you know, every 2 years, if there's a new justice, there'll be a new case. And I think that's what's going to happen now. And I believe statistically, under this map, closer to, you know, there's 99 assembly members, it'd be closer to 50-50, they say. So, but as Howard and I both know, I mean, I have what's considered a Democrat district right now. And, you know, I won it, Howard won it when he first ran. People vote for as much the person as they do in the party in the rural areas. And I think you really can't look at a map where they say, okay, this district seat is 55% Democrat, 45% Republican, so therefore it's going to go Democrat. That doesn't work. The most I've outrun the top of the ticket, I think it was 2018, they told me, and I think I ran it by 12%. I know, Howard, in 2012, you did about the same in that election. So, and there's a lot of rural seats like mine, both Democrat and Republican. Representative Doyle up by La Crosse is a Democrat who represents a Republican seat. So you really can't look at a map and see the statistics or the breakdown and automatically say, okay, this is going to be a Democrat seat, it's going to be a Republican seat. I will say that Governor Hughes' map, I voted for it. It was telling that all the Democrats just hated it. I do believe that they thought they were going to get a much better map. Some of those maps that were submitted of the six were pretty ugly. I mean, they drew me in with all the way down to Dubuque in one map and took Representative Trano, who lives by Dubuque, and took him all the way over to Beloit. So it was just some interesting drawings around. But no, I look forward to representing and getting to know whoever I don't know now. So
those of us in the public, though, it's very confusing for the constituents, isn't it?
It is. You know, I don't think people understand what happened yet because they don't. The map issue was a core group of people were the ones pushing it in the public and stuff. 90% of nobody cared about maps and drawing maps and stuff. I think a lot of people I'm finding out are kind of shocked, like that I'm not going to be their representative anymore. Howard won't be their senator once they're finding out. So I think once people start paying attention, and I've talked to people in Mount Horeb, I was just up the other day introducing myself, and they're not happy to be drawn in where they are either, some of these people, because they're more urban and they want to be a more urban seat, where the seat now is gone more rural for them, and they know that. So it's going to be fun. But I will tell you, I will miss my Richland Center piece, Lone Rock. You know, I have just that corner, but with Lone Rock and Ithaca, I've gotten to know a lot of people there, and will continue to if they need anything, I will definitely help Representative Kurtz when he represents the area and do whatever thing. So I told Tony, and I'd take him around to introduce him to some of those people. It's a great area.
How many senators are representing Richland County then in the new map, Howard?
One.
Just one?
Yeah.
Just one.
Yeah, same as right now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, it'll be, this will be part of the 14th Senate District, which is now Joan Baldwin represents the, she's the senator for the 14th Senate District. And and she's somebody else that will be likely, she's from Markesan. She'll likely be moving into the district to represent this area. So, you know, and I, one of the biggest concerns that I've heard is, as I've been out and about and, you know, all over my district is, I was talking with people in Highland yesterday and Dodgeville on Saturday night and Lancaster the other day is, are we going to have rural representation? Okay, because that's my, and that's their biggest concern. I think it's a valid concern here is like, you know, are the issues in Boaz going to be heard, you know, when you're part of a district that includes portions of, you know, good part of Dane County and the city of Madison, you know? And because like right now with, you know, I mentioned Joan Baldwin's name. She's the chair of the Senate Agriculture and Tourism Committee, a strong ag person. She's got a John Deere dealership, very, very connected to the ag community. I'm the vice chair of the Senate Ag and Tourism Committee and stuff. So, you know, like in the ag area, you've got your chair and vice chair, you know, carved out of their districts, you know, and stuff. So, you know, there's a concern by a number of people in the rural areas, especially the ag community, about kind of the, are we going to have a voice, you know, down the road?
Very important. Well, I know that less than a week ago, the final day of the official Senate floor session ended. There were some wins and losses, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the assembly adjourned in last month. And largely what the Senate did was take up some of the bills that the assembly had passed. So, there's some of my bills, you know, got passed all the way through, which is a good thing. We've talked about this in the past, this electric vehicle charging proposal. And this is to permit the private sector businesses, and Quick Trips, the Culvers, and businesses like that, hotels, to be able to charge for power. Because right now, in state law, the only people that can charge for electricity are utilities, okay? And so this bill will enable a Quick Trip to put in charging stations and to charge people that drive electric vehicles. And also, as part of that, I think that's important to note that there's going to be a 3 cent per kilowatt hour tax that goes into the transportation fund. Okay, that's part of the negotiations that we had. So we got that done. That bill is off to the governor. There were a couple of Department of Revenue technical kinds of things that we got done. And then I also, at the request of a constituent, we changed the audit requirements, and this is for CPAs that do audits of nonprofits. What's happened is that right now, if a nonprofit gets $500,000 or more in revenue a year in donations, they have to have an audit. Well, out of that, especially in rural areas, there aren't CPA firms that even may even do the audits and stuff. And so, you know, it becomes an administrative burden, you know, and years ago, you know, my firm, we used to do these audits for, you know, a big discount. We do them in the off season after, you know, our busy season, tax season was over and stuff. Well, CPAs are going through the same staffing issues that every business is going through. And so they just don't have staff either to do these. So what the bill that I authored at the request of the of a nonprofit and with the support of the Wisconsin Institute of CPAs, the CPAs support this, is raising that threshold from $500,000 of revenue to $1 million of revenue in a year. So again, because, you know, people, if they're donating to a charity, a United Fund, Boys and Girls Club, any of those kinds of charities, if you're donating to them, you know, they want that as much money as possible to go to the charity, the purpose for that organization, not to pay accountants, you know, to do audits. So we got that through. That's off to the governor. And then the final bill that I got through was the had to do with the interest rates that the Department of Revenue charges. So if you're late in paying your income taxes to the state, the Department of Revenue charges you 12% interest. If the Department of Revenue determines that they owe you money, they pay you 3%. So there's a 9% spread there between what they charge on late payments and what they pay on if you have an overpayment. So the bill that I authored set the new rate at 6%. Doesn't matter whether you owe the state or the state owes you, you know, which I think is, a in today's interest rate environment, reasonable rate. So and going back through the history of this thing, it was interesting. The 12% rate was set back in 1981. Now, I think you're old enough, Phil, to remember the interest rate environment back then. Yeah. And it was, it was crazy, 21% interest rate. So I can understand why the Department of Revenue set their interest at 12% back then. But in today's environment, it's, pretty excessive.
Todd, anything you'd like to add in terms of the assembly and some things that were accomplished the past session?
Yeah, I had a pretty good week last week. A lot of my bills were taken up by the Senate. I had a bill signing last week, nothing made with the governor, updating the campaign ethics code and stuff for the department. So that was a pretty simple bill. But I did pretty good this session. I think I only had 3 or 4 bills not make it through, and so I should have quite a few bill signings coming up. But Senate last week passed a bill that I worked really hard on with Senator Romain Quinn up north to keep the Office of School Safety going. I know that's important to the school districts out here. And I always say some of the best bills or fun bills to do are ones that come from your constituents. And Howard and I had a police officer in my district. Last summer when it was really hot and stuff, you heard about cases where police canine dogs were inadvertently dying in the heated car, and something would happen. There were a few cases. So one of the officers, Mineral Point and Linden officer, got a hold of Howard and I, and by state law, police officers can't have their windows tinted because they're under the same rules we are, and a percent of windows tinting and stuff. And so the officer, along with the police association, sheriff's association, thought this is ridiculous. We should have an exemption because we got to keep these canine officers safe. They are officers. They're sworn in, dogs. And so that was kind of a fun bill to work on, and that is headed to the governor. It passed the Senate next week. And there was actual opposition to it, so it was an interesting. It's one of those bills that sounds like a no-brainer. So I got it through the Assembly the last day of session, and they got it through the Senate last week. So those are the kind of bills. I would say probably a quarter to half of all the bills I put out come from my district, and so those are the fun ones to get through. So
sometimes you wonder why would there be opposition, but I guess. There's always different opinions.
Well, right? It came down to, why should police officers be able to tint their windows and I can't? Now, these are legislators saying, there's a few legislators. Why can't I tint my windows and officers can tint their windows? Well, okay. I mean, that's Howard shaking his, he knows what I'm talking about. So that, yes, those kind of bills that really make this job worth it. So.
And the school safety, you mentioned that, the school safety office too.
Yeah, that just funded it until, I believe, August of next year. That was all started with federal funding. In 2018, I actually did the bill, and then it was there was a school safety grant too for $100 million for schools to beef up security. The funding ran out. The governor used ARPA funds to keep it going. Now the money's running out. On that in December it will. So this is just a stopgap till the next budget cycle, and then we'll work on seeing how we can get it done. It's just a short term, but it was pretty, especially in our rural areas, the schools rely on this tip line and things, and so it was important. Didn't know if we'd get her through the line, so I was happy when I saw it on the Senate calendar last week, just because there's a question whether they need all these positions. It was 14 and a half positions, and so, and if the office has grown. So it's, this is a, when you go from a federal funded program to the state taking it over, it's always, people really take a hard look at it. And so we'll spend the next few months looking at that program again to see if we can get it in the budget, trim it down maybe, and figure out how it works.
Todd Novak and Howard Markline on The Morning Show. We'll be back with more in a moment. State Senator Howard Markline, Representative Todd Novak, our guests on our morning show get together today here on WRCO. We'll be we're getting real near an election, April 2nd, 2024. And Howard, we want to kind of hit on a couple of the constitutional questions on the ballot. Sometimes it's hard for us to kind of know what those entail when we go into the polling booths. And
right.
Maybe you could shed a little light on that.
Sure, sure. Well, first of all, I guess I encourage everybody to vote, you know, in April. I mean, sometimes I believe our elections in April, these are the local school board, town officials, county board, mayor, those races, they probably have more impact on our lives than who's president, you know, in all honesty. Yet people will vote for president come November, and they don't vote in April. So I guess I just encourage people to vote, you know, come in April. So I've already voted. I'm not sure where the heck I'm going to be on election day. And so I traditionally just get an absentee ballot, and I fill it out in my kitchen table. And also, it for me, like there's two questions on the ballot, constitutional questions, okay? And it gives me a chance to look at those and study those and, you know, be a more informed voter than going into the ballot box and think, you know, or even like with names sometimes, sometimes people just vote based on they saw a name or whatever rather than, you know, actually doing their homework. So there's going to be two constitutional amendments on the ballot in April. The first one, and I'm not going to read the legal stuff because I'll tell you what, it's not pretty. And people ask, why do you have to word it like this? Unfortunately, we have to word this stuff because it's got to be legalese to put it into statute. But the first question has to do with not allowing outside money to come into the state to for running elections, basically, okay? And the issue occurred back in 2020 where Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, I believe, Todd, you're the Facebook guy, and contributed a phenomenal amount of money to help with elections around the country. And in Wisconsin, I think there was five communities that he helped, tended to be larger communities. One was up in Green Bay. And the question there was, you know, should outside money be used to come in and, you know, help influence potentially an election? And so, you know, if you, you know, and I guess, you know, I think there's a concern by a lot of people that there's too much money in politics anyway. And, you know, last time it was Zuckerberg, it could be a conservative billionaire putting money in next time. And what this first question on the ballot says is, should it be disallowed, this outside money? So if you vote yes, you don't want this outside money coming in. The second question has to do with the using for staffing purposes. And again, this happened back in 2020 where some of this money was used to hire staff. So, and again, I think it was in Green Bay where some of the volunteers, and I'm using air quotes here, that for the election, local elections, were paid for by this outside group. And so question two basically says that anybody that runs your election should be from those that are appointed, are legally authorized to run your elections. Our local officials, local clerks, and duly appointed poll workers. So that's what the second question on the ballot is all about.
Is it hard to find poll workers, Todd?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking, it's, well, anymore, too, it's also hard to find clerks, mm-hmm. Simply because, you know, you're sitting there all day and stuff, and I'm finding out, at least in my district, some of the clerks, you know, I have town clerks that have been there for 30, 40 years, and they want to get out, and elections have become more intense, more heated and stuff, and a lot of them are, you know, just have retired, so it's hard to find that experience because you really need an experienced people. I, for one, you know, you talk about election stuff, our clerks do a really good job out here in rural Wisconsin. And I know, like Howard mentioned, the Green Bay case, that's what that second question is dealt with. They just use that money. And the group that gave the money, which relates back to Mark Zuckerberg, took over the elections. They worked the polls. They did all this. The clerk actually quit because she was pushed out. And so that just is not a good look. Regardless, what left or right groups, nobody should be allowed to put money into the elections because I think it's setting precedent. So this will stop all that.
There are people that are concerned, too, that, you know, rigged machines and those kind of things, that came into play the last election, too.
Yeah, and I know enough about elections and stuff. I'm just speaking from a rural perspective. I mean, I'm not talking big cities, but I firmly believe in rural areas that safe, secure, these clerks do a darn good job and take it serious. You know, I don't think you hear anything about that. I think the way we run our elections out here is a lot different than the big cities. You know, in Milwaukee, they have a central count, they call it. It's one location in that whole big city that counts ballots, and you're transporting them and to this location, and you know, they don't get them counted until 3 or 4 in the morning after, you know, the election. And I think that causes some people to take pause and wonder if something's going on. And so, yeah.
That was in the news just today. I think wasn't there some sort of bill to possibly change that in Milwaukee, Howard?
That was the Monday count bill. And mm-hmm. what it would do is, under the Monday count, is would permit, there's 7 cities in the state that count, they have a central counting system, and Milwaukee is the biggest. These are for the absentee ballots, okay? Now, I talked a couple minutes ago about my absentee ballot. In the town of Spring Green, what happens is during the day, when it's slow, they open up the absentee ballots and make sure everything's filled out properly on the envelope and all that stuff, and they run them through when it's slow. They just, so that by 8 o'clock at night, you know, it's, you know, they're not waiting for anything. In Milwaukee, again, that being the biggest city that does this, they've got a central processing facility that, again, you know, all thousands of these ballots go in and are processed, and they don't get it done till well after the polls close. And as Todd said, there's this question about that. And so the bill that was proposed had to do with permitting absentee ballots to be counted on Monday so that everything would be done by 8 o'clock on Tuesday night. Yeah, all the ballots are counted. Now, I think there's some concerns by some people that, you know, right now the voter integrity and all, you know, all that stuff, the poll workers, you know, you talk about poll workers. If you're going to do it for 2 days now, then you're going to get the same number of staff and stuff to watch it for 2 days. And so, and I think that, you know, one thing that I don't know why in Milwaukee it takes as long as it does. I just, you know, because I would think that, you know, if you've gone through multiple, and this goes way back, this is not a recent phenomenon. This goes back for decades where, the totals aren't done in Milwaukee until well into the middle of the night. Why don't they just hire more people and or figure it out, you know, and stuff? So anyway, so, you know, I think I would be okay with allowing a Monday count, but you know, I think there's also another solution to that, and that's just telling, you know, Milwaukee needs to staff up and do what they can to make sure that the on election day that those ballots get counted. So also I wanted to mention, you know, 4 years ago, COVID, everything was shut down on St. Patrick's Day at 5 o'clock, right? And so we had an April election back in 2020, and Peggy, my wife, and I volunteered to work the polls that April because we had so many of our poll workers were, you know, it probably their 80s, you know, and so, and we're concerned about health and all that. So we worked. Now, I have a much better appreciation of the process, having been there and working that election that day. And Peggy continues to volunteer for all the elections now. And so I encourage people, you know, I mean, there's a lot of opportunities here. You know, if you can, it's only 2-3 days, maybe 4 days a year potentially that you got to do this. And but it's a great opportunity. And I think it gives people at least it gave me a much better understanding of the kinds of the process. And as Todd said, I'm pretty comfortable out here with the election integrity. I don't have any concerns that in the town of Spring Green, there's not people voting that shouldn't vote. And, you know, the process seems to work pretty well.
Mm-hmm. I think it does, too. You want to touch on revenue a little bit here as we have some time, Howard?
Yeah, so the Department of Revenue released their first 7 months of the fiscal year. We end our year on June 30th. So these numbers are from July 1st, 2023 through January 31st, 2024. And it's something that I keep an eye on very closely. And income taxes, individual income taxes, the money that comes out of people's paychecks, that is up 1.1%, which I would argue is inflation, maybe not even inflation, okay? Because people got raises, you know, I think. So sales tax, again, compared to the prior year, actual numbers compared to the prior year, up 1.7%. Again, that's barely inflation. I would argue inflation's at least 2 or 3%, you know? So it doesn't mean that we're selling more hamburgers and more cars or whatever. It's, you know, so... and then corporate taxes is down 5.7%, okay? And when you go through all the bottom line on this thing is that our revenue for the state of Wisconsin is up 0.3%, okay, for the first 7 months of the year. Now, and I've talked to the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau, nothing alarming in this at all, but it's a far cry from what we have gotten used to, I think, for the last couple of years when, you know, inflation was higher and there's just a lot more money coming in. And also, the other concern I have is looking at this corporate number being down, you know, almost 6% compared to the prior year. Again, these are actual numbers, not projections. You know, I've talked to a lot of businesses, and I think business is okay, you know. Their sales are probably okay, but their costs are up. You know, there's an awful lot of, you know, costs that are up. So, and, you know, you hear in the national news that, you know, the consumers are continuing to spend and all that stuff, which is, but they're also using their credit cards to spend, you know, and savings rates are down and all this. So, you know, I guess, you know, I'm just watching this closely, you know. We need to keep an eye on it, and I don't think it foretells a recession, but, you know, it's something that, you know, I'm going to be keeping an eye on here down the road.
Agriculture is certainly big in your area, Todd, and we're getting into another big season here for people out there digging and planting and everything else.
Yeah, it's, you know, in that nice period we had, I saw some farmers in the field stuff, but like I said, we still need rain. We still need to replenish from last year and stuff. So I know some of the milk price is not the best right now, and that has some... farmers, you know, very cautiously optimistic, but go back to what Howard just said, a lot of their issue coming up is the costs. I mean, costs are, I think they've gone down a little bit, but the price of fertilizer and diesel and gas is up. And when you're milk price is down and your prices or your expenses are up, you know, the farmers are very resilient people. I haven't got, you know, I talked to a lot of them, and like Howard was just the cattleman's banquet the other night, and I'm sure he did too. They're always glass half full type people. So, but they, farmers have got, most farmers have got this down to a knack. They're watching, they know. And so hopefully, A, we get rain and the cost comes down some on some of the stuff this spring or this year for them. But keeps up like this, we'll have corn planted not for very far off.
Not too far down the road. What about jobs? How are they doing?
Yeah, here? That's kind of what I kind of look at jobs. I not so much around here, but if you kind of watch the whole national picture, there's companies that are laying off thousands of people here and there. I was just reading this week, because I do watch ag stuff this weekend. Tyson closed 4 plants, like a town of 7,000, a hog processing plant in Iowa just by Des Moines. Tyson closed their processing plant there, 1,800 workers out of a job in a town of 7,000. So I can't imagine what that's going to be like. So you're seeing those big corporations starting to do that, tighten up. So I'm not sure what that means for us out here. I think you can pretty much go anywhere in Southwest Wisconsin, there's somebody hiring, but I don't know if this is going to trickle down to the mom-pop jobs or the businesses. And so that's kind of what I always look at is nationwide what's going on in some of these companies.
If someone has some questions, Howard, how's the best way to get a hold of you?
Probably give us a call, you know, 608-266-0703 is the office number. And follow up on what Todd was saying. We went to Highland yesterday for the St. Patrick's event at the it's a church, and I saw a couple corn planters pulled out of the machine shed yesterday, and I thought, wow, it's and you know, this time of year, and we joke with Travis Tranel about this, you know, it's like, you know, the minute you're starting to plant corn, Phil, I got to get out there, even if it's maybe too early, you know. And it's kind of interesting to watch, you know, over the next few weeks here, it'll be fun watching farmers. Yeah, they're raring to go, you know. Yeah. So
tillage-wise, though, I don't remember a year where it was this early, where people are starting to work up the soil. Even in February, I saw people out there.
Right, yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, we always tease because, you know, Travis has a huge dairy farm with his family, and Tony Kurtz has a smaller organic farm, and they always have this little competition of who's going to get done first. And Travis will send a text out on Sunday and say, "Do you think Tony's done on a January?" And say, "Do you think Tony's done picking his corn yet?" So it's kind of, and reminds me growing up, because that was always a thing. And with my grandpa and stuff, is who was planting first and who had the straightest rows. Because back then, you didn't have the equipment you do now that lays out where you plant. That was always a source of pride for my grandpa. Him and the neighbors would always compete who had the straightest rows of corn. And that was a big deal to those old guys. So
yeah, you had to go by the marker on the planter.
Yeah, the marker. And nobody could plant except my dad or my grandpa on our farms. And it was kind of fun because it had to be just right.
Yeah, and you wouldn't know until it came up a few weeks later then.
So, yeah, or once in a while the seeds would get mixed up, so you'd have some corn to load, they're different in corn, and then you were in big trouble. So.
No doubt. Anything else either of you gentlemen would like to add here before we close today?
I guess, you know, we talked earlier, you know, the Senate adjourned, but there's a lot of committee activity going on tomorrow. I've got a joint audit committee meeting. Taking up a couple of audit issues. Joint Finance Committee, which I co-chair, continues to be meeting here all year, basically, as supplemental funding requests are made to the committee or approval is needed for purchases of land, sales of land, as well as legal settlements and that sort of thing. So, well, some people think, you know, we're not in Madison at all anymore. There's a lot of, at least with me, between audit committee and the joint finance committee, there's still quite a bit of stuff going on periodically throughout the spring, summer, and fall.
Any listening sessions or anything like that coming up?
No, not yet. I'm, like I said, I'm just getting out to know some of the people in my new district that's coming up. And I like this time of year on these breaks and stuff, even summer. I like going around. Just some days I don't even know where I'm going, and I'll drive around the district and stop into X business or Y business or the courthouse and just say hi, and that usually turns into one thing. So that's kind of what I enjoy. Plus, in the spring, a lot of school groups come, fourth graders come to this Capitol. I'm not that far from Madison, so I do like to drive up and do some office work and talk to the kids, and that's kind of the best part, one of the best parts of this job. So,
and you're a new candidate in Mount Horeb and Blue Mounds area then?
Yes, I yes, I will be a new candidate up there, and actually they're beautiful communities, so it's not that I, you know, it's just yeah, and like I said, the eastern half, I have Barneville and that area too, but I know so many people there. So
the next time we talk will be after the election on April 2nd.
So. It will. Again, I just encourage people to, you know, get out, vote. I talked to somebody, a truck driver yesterday, and I know he's going to be gone. You know, he drives over the road, and, you know, a guy like him ought to be getting an absentee ballot and, you know, fulfill his, and, you know, again, this person I talked to is very opinionated on issues, and, you know, I hope the heck he votes, you know. So
plan ahead then.
Yeah, clearly, you know, and again, somebody like that especially ought to be just requesting absentee ballots as a normal course, you know, because I bet he doesn't know where he's going to be in August or in November this year. So,
yep, very much. And sometimes people don't know even where they go vote. So yeah, it's easier to do that.
Yeah, and I remember this is when I first ran for the state assembly in 2010, and there was a this is west of Darlington on 81. A family had put up my signs along their fields west of Darlington, and very big supporters, you know, big farm family. And several months after the election, just for the heck of it, I went into, and you can tell who votes and who doesn't vote. They didn't vote. And so I ran into them at a fair or someplace, and I said, "Here, you're big rah-rah supporters of mine, and you didn't even take the time to vote." And they said, "The combine broke." And we were working on that till 9 o'clock that night. And so there's a case, too, where, you know, life happens, you know, and sometimes, you know, that's why, you know, people can intend to vote, but if they don't, you know, actually vote, it's a good intention is all it is.
Indeed. Thanks, gentlemen, for coming in today.
Thank you. It's good to see you.
Thanks, Phil.
Todd Novak, Howard Markline, representatives from our area, Representative Novak and State Senator Howard Markline, during a monthly visit here on The Morning Show.